Hello there, this is Bane. When I'm not out on the streets of Gotham hunting the Batman, I find myself listening to Part-Time Fanboy on a regular basis. Be sure to check out Part-Time Fanboy at www.parttimefanboy.com for somewhat weekly podcasts and reviews about various fanboy-related subjects. Also be sure to like them on Facebook and follow them on the Twitter. Do it now, or I'll have to do something awful to your spine.
Part-Time Fanboy, and we're back. I'm Christian with Corey and Paul. I'm a little low on energy. I got hit with the flu this week, and my daughter got hit with the flu the weekend before, so it's been a rough week and a half at my house.
That's not good.
I hope I don't catch it from you through the podcast.
I hope not, man, because it sucks so bad. I can't even tell you. Oh, man.
That sounds like a bad supervillain plot right there.
It's really
a virus that spreads through computers. A computer virus.
I'm surprised. Yeah, I'm surprised nobody's done that before.
Yeah. We better get to work.
Better get to work. Oh, I think we're going to be coming up with lots of ideas during this podcast.
Why don't you tell everybody the topic?
Well, I think, what I've wanted to do the way I got the idea for this particular one is a friend of mine has been listening to the pod, a friend of mine from high school has been listening to our podcast, and he's been liking them a lot, and he was like, oh, you guys should do a podcast on all the best Marvel movies. And I was like, that's too easy, you know, because Marvel's been doing a lot of really good superhero movies like the past couple of years. So the past several years. So I started thinking, what would be a more interesting podcast than the best Marvel movies, which is too easy a subject for these couple of several years. So I figured we should do the worst superhero movies of all time. And as I've been saying in our emails, there's so many to choose from. So
veritable cornucopia.
It's a subject that we could go on for a while, and probably will. So if this does go long, I'm just going to let listeners know that we'll split it up into two parts, and we'll debut one week, and then the next week we'll do the next half, like Paul and I did with our horror movies during Halloween. So, who wants to get started with the superhero movie smackdown?
Let's set some ground rules here. Do you think we should go by ascending or descending order of horrible, or you know, should we just sort of freestyle it?
Well, I think we should kind of freestyle it, okay. Unless you guys want to do it differently. If you want to outvote me, I mean, my problem
I wanted to do it alphabetical by associate producer.
I have the same level of disdain for my picks, or probably some of your picks across the board. So I don't think like
well, then worse. Why don't we just start it with what I consider to be the worst movie ever made? Not just the worst superhero movie, but the worst movie ever made.
I don't know. I think I got some worse ones than what you're going to say, but go ahead.
Batman and Robin.
Ooh. That's bad.
Yeah, it's pretty bad.
Batman and Robin, I went to see it, and I had a free pass to to go see it, and I went in on a free pass, and it was so bad that I actually left and asked for my money back.
Your and, money and so, is zero?
Yeah, no, no, they actually paid me to watch it.
So you cheated the poor theater owner out of giving you your money back.
They owed me after that.
They paid you to peaceably leave the theater?
Yes, yes. They paid me to not, you know, just start, you know, shredding the screen with, you know...
Oh, my God.
With fanboy rage.
That's so funny.
You know, it actually gave me a headache.
Did it really?
The movie was so bad that it gave me
your
a
dog
headache.
Doesn't like it either.
It yeah, made dogs oh. howl and throw the neighborhood.
Right now he's thinking, you know, look how he writes Schumacher.
It quieted his
down.
Is that
the name of your dog?
No, no. I just mentioning the name Joel Schumacher just makes.
I see.
There. I had to use the first name.
Oh, gotcha.
He's like, you could have been any Schumacher.
Nice.
So.
I have to make a confession that I've never seen this movie.
Really?
Wow.
Yes.
You're better for it.
This is the one Batman movie that for some reason I just never got around to seeing in the theater when it came out. Something about the trailer, the amount of villains in it, just... there was something in me that just said, you know what, I don't think you need to see that. And
good instincts.
And when the reviews came out, yeah, I still have not seen it to this day. I've seen maybe like some small clips, but I remember just being infuriated that Schwarzenegger got cast as Mr. Freeze, yeah. Especially after the animated show had done such an incredible job with Mr. Freeze, and that they were going to just, you know, shoehorn Schwarzenegger in there, and obviously he was going to try and make some, you know, bad quips during the movie.
Well, you know,
the puns were just ridiculous.
Really?
A lot of the other movies that we're going to talk about were at least successful on, like, some level, or on, like, one level, you know what I mean? And this one just fails across the board in every single way. There is nothing good about the movie.
That is so sad, because I remember seeing... I mean, not so sad. I mean, obviously, I know it's a crappy movie. I've never bared to, like, watch it. But I think that Clooney as Bruce Wayne was a big missed opportunity, you know, because...
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, he could have been, I think, a really convincing Bruce Wayne or Batman.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Maybe more a convincing Bruce Wayne than Batman, but I remember sitting there, and I remember the rumor got out that Kilmer wasn't going to do another Batman. Like, he was like, I'm not going to do it anymore. And people were like, who's going to be the next Batman? And I very much remember... these were during my acting days and having waited tables and coming home like late that night and then sitting at a drawing board in front of the TV, and I was just drawing something, I can't remember what it is, and I looked up at the TV and it was like I had recorded an episode of ER or something, and uh-huh. He was on the screen, and I'm like, and that's before they announced him, and I said, that's Bruce Wayne right there, that guy, George Clooney, he's Bruce Wayne. And they cast him, and I remember being really excited, thinking like, oh, they nailed it, they got Bruce Wayne right, blah, 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 it's going to be good. And then, you know, the news starts rolling out, Schwarzenegger is Mr. Freeze, Uma Thurman is Poison Ivy, who I don't necessarily think would have been a bad choice in another director's hands. No, but
I'll be honest with you, Schwarzenegger's not the worst thing about that movie.
What is?
The script is just atrocious.
Wait, tell me about the story. So, like, what, Corey? You could chime in too. Like, what?
Well,
I just
pulled up the Wikipedia page on Batman and Robin just out of curiosity to sort of see, like, you know, and Paul, and you're saying just on every level it was terrible. It's like, well, surely there must have been something, like maybe special effects were okay, maybe the costuming was halfway decent. And so I'm just reading, sort of seeing if it was nominated for anything whatsoever.
Yeah.
And I'm seeing there's this little inset blurb where Joel Schumacher is apologizing for Batman and
Robin. Oh, yeah, he apologized for it.
I never knew that.
Oh, you didn't know that? Yeah, he apologized for it.
Yeah, there's actually the Akiva Goldsman, the screenwriter, publicly apologized for it later.
Yeah, and he did Lost in Space too, so he's got a lot to apologize for.
There was a time where I would not see anything that had his name attached to it.
I know, he was so bad for so long.
Beautiful Mind. I actually refused to see Beautiful Mind first because of that. And the only thing that changed my mind was I saw an interview with him, and he just sort of talked about, you know, his period during his life that he wrote Lost in Space and Batman and Robin, and you know, he just was like, yeah, you know, I was really full of myself. I thought I could do no wrong. You know, I was basically delusional, you know, and he apologized for it. And after that, I'm like, well, okay, I'll take a risk and see it. And you know, and since then, he's actually done some projects that I think are really good.
He's like a co-producer on Fringe too. Which
correct. He's written a few of the best episodes too.
Yeah, which is really stunning to me when I watch that show. I mean, I have not watched any of this current season. Mm-hmm. They kind of lost me a little bit. I've got them all saved on my DVR, but
I just thought of something nice to say about Batman and Robin.
What did you think about?
Yes.
Pretty much the whole movie was in focus.
Pretty much.
Whoever was the focus puller on that movie rocked it.
What's the story? Like, what happens in the movie? Because I didn't see it. I
don't remember.
Okay.
They're on ice skates at one point.
Yeah,
sort of
a loose thing is that, Victor Freeze is trying to revive his wife, who is, you know, an icicle. He becomes Mr. Freeze. They also get involved with Poison Ivy, who is a ethnobotanist who's researching plants that ends up actually becoming the drug Venom. Bane is actually small character in it too. But you know, it's just the thing is that Schumacher approached the thing like it was campy, not even campy like the Batman TV show was campy, although I think that may have been what he was sort of aiming for, but there's just no sense of seriousness about it at all. It just seems lackluster. You know, I mean, some of the scenes, the way they play out, I'm like, wow, God, did you rehearse this? Or are you just sort of making this up as you go along? Everything is in a very sort of strange Dayglow neon palette, that, you know, and every shot is sort of one of those Dutch angle off kilter things, and there's lots of zooms and things like that. It's just, it's very, it's just a lot of stuff moving around the screen while nothing ever really happens.
Huh. I think because it's in sort of my list, I think there's probably overall worse movies, but all the movies that I'm going to sort of talk about have a moment where I'm sitting in the theater and I'm just stunned at a sudden bad moment.
Yeah.
And I think for this one, it was when Batman and Robin arrive on, I think, some island or something, and Robin says, "Holy metal." And Batman just turns and looks at him. He's like, "What did you say?" He's like, the metal, there's holes in it." And it's just like, wow, really?
Yeah, the moment I left the theater was Batman and Robin are both under Poison Ivy's love spell. And they're bidding for the right to her hand, so they're bidding money for her, you know. And so, like, Batman throws out $1 million, and Robin throws out $2 million, and they just start going back and forth. And Batman then pulls out an American Express card and says $16 million, and he slaps it down, and it's an American Express card on it that says Batman, and the expiration date on it is forever.
I forgot about that part.
And
you make me cry.
And like that, it's that kind of a movie where I just sat, and at that moment I was like, what the hell am I watching?
Oh my God.
I can't justify sitting here watching anymore. I would rather go get into a fight with a theater manager than sit here for another moment of this.
I needed that so badly. Thank you. Like, oh my God. All right. Okay, breathe.
Yeah, it really is. Like I said, I cannot tell you how bad this is. It is the worst movie ever.
Really?
I don't know, man. I've and, got and this some is pretty coming, bad ones
and
coming
this
up.
This is coming from someone who sits through Ed Wood stuff, you know? Like, Ed, I mean, Ed Wood, like, at least he had the excuse of, like, he was sort of making it up as he went along, you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And this he had is, no budget.
And he had no budget. This is, like, an unlimited budget with people who supposedly know what they're doing,
yeah,
and
know.
And producing something that's just unwatchable.
Oh my
there's
God.
Only there's only so many ice puns you can handle being delivered by Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Let's kick some ice.
Oh man,
he must have said freeze 50 times.
Yeah, it really is bad. But oh, I'm sorry, I thought of something else positive. The makeup I thought was pretty good.
The makeup.
Actually, I did see that it was awarded. It was nominated for a few things.
What?
The Saturn Award for Best Fantasy Film.
You're kidding.
As well as categories for Best Makeup and Best Costume. Well, according to the Never Wrong Wikipedia.
That okay, really... I could go with best. Oh, but okay. So hold on. Sorry, we got to get to the best costume thing. This is the movie that was well known. It's still well known for the gratuitous bat nipples and
but the nipples were in the one before it.
Yeah, but they were more pronounced in this one, and there were just and there were like dozens of sort of like crotch and ass shots through this whole thing too. I mean, there are just moments where like it. Just
especially
like,
with Chris O'Donnell.
Yeah, I mean, literally, like the camera would like zoom into their cod pieces or their ass, and it was just like, what the? I mean, when I was sitting there wondering, was like, who's the target audience for this thing? Like, because if it's kids, like their parents are going to be horrified by this, and you know, and if it's adults, then why are you doing this? Like, you know, pitching it with the story sensibilities of a six-year-old. You know? I mean, because it really did. Dude, you know Axe Cop, right?
Oh, sure.
Yes, I've heard of
that. Yeah. Webcomic.
Yeah, the way, and it's basically a six-year-old telling his stories to his brother who draws them and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Parts of this movie play like that. Like, literally, like they're a six-year-old just narrating stuff that's happening, but
like
without
off the fly.
But without the whimsy and innocence of a six-year-old, you know, imagination.
Oh, my God. All right, we got to stop with that because I'm going to have a stroke by laughing too hard.
See, it's the movie that's so bad that it gives people strokes.
Corey, what is another pick that you have?
Let me look back at what I had said. So this is probably not technically maybe considered a superheroes, but they kind of basically are. The Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, those live action movies. The first one was pretty cool.
The first one's good. Come on.
Yeah.
The first one was pretty entertaining.
I haven't seen any of the others.
Which one did they bring Vanilla Ice in for?
That was the second one, right? The Secret of the Ooze, right?
And that's the moment where I'm just like, that's that moment of, what am I watching?
So did you see it, Corey?
Yeah, I saw it in theaters. I remember.
You went to see the second one in the theater, even with Vanilla Ice in the trailer?
Yeah. Oh, well, because I was pretty into the Turtles, mostly the cartoon. I didn't really discover the comic so much later. But so I was like, kind of, I don't know if I was excited, but I liked the first one, and so I was like, okay, well, you know, let's just go to the second one.
Yeah.
And I remember him being in the trailer, but I think I was just like, well, he's probably just a cameo, you know, like I just kind of figured, you know, or maybe they're just showing clips of the music video in the trailer. He's not actually in the movie itself.
You were in nerd denial.
Yeah, I was. But they run around like some sort of club or something like that. They're chasing I think the Foot Clan maybe, and then they just crash through a wall and they happen to stumble into a Vanilla Ice concert. And he just keeps, you know, why would you stop performing at that point?
By the way, that's the only way anyone ever attends a Vanilla Ice concert. Right. They happen to stumble in it in the middle of a fight.
Yeah, through a wall. Yeah.
So. What is the plot of the second movie? It's like them discovering the ooze that turned them into the turtles or something?
Yeah, I think it sort of expands on their origin. I don't, you know, usually these movies, you know, there's that moment that just totally takes me out of the movie and horrifies me. And at that point, all memory of story go out the window. So I always have a hard time remembering what the movie's actually about after that.
Well, didn't, like, the Shredder, who's, you know, the main villain, didn't he, like, sort of try to create his own little mutant army.
Yeah,
in that
yeah,
one.
He like, tried to.
Wait, so Paul, you've seen this one, the second one?
Yeah, man, I've seen so much shit.
And I remember as a fan being mad that in this movie he creates his own mutated villains. But in the cartoon, there's Rocksteady and Bebop. But in the movie, there's like two characters they make up. They're already there. Why not just use the characters that already exist?
That's great. So two of your favorite villains got the shaft in the movie. So
yeah,
upset.
They just got replaced by anonymous, you know, crazy, mutated, whatever they were.
So
I remember.
After being burned by the second one, you still managed to see the third one?
I don't know. I may not have actually seen the third one.
Oh, really?
You know what? I'm like
The second one is like the Vanilla Ice concert thing. That's like the climax of the movie. Too.
It is. Yeah. That's right.
Is it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Like Vanilla Ice actually helps them to defeat the Shredder because they use they use an amp to like they're playing like one of those keytars.
Yeah.
And they end up like. Blasting through a wall, and like then they're like there's some more ooze stuff, and
I think
oh
they might.
Goodness.
I think it might be one of those like for some reason sound waves defeating.
One of those moments. but that literally is the climax of the movie, and it's
I think Shredder gets mutated.
Oh yeah, that's right.
He's like a super Shredder.
Ultimate guy. Yeah.
And somehow his armor gets mutated with him.
I just had to take my retainer out. You guys are making me laugh so hard.
The ooze actually like mutates armor and clothes also. So
yeah, that's right. The genetic material, the DNA of clothing.
Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 3 is Turtles Back in Time.
I remember looking at the movie poster. I did not see that one. I think I saw two, and I was like, I'm out.
They go back to ancient Japan somehow. They time travel. Yeah. Which I have not seen, and there is a trailer for it, which I may watch later. Afterward, holy cow! Oh my god, those are some two really awesome choices right there. No, wait, Corey, did you ever see the CGI movie that I think? What's his face? The director of The Killer, Hard-Boiled, John Woo. That he directed, that he produced. He did a CGI, like a pretty decent CGI movie. It's not perfect, but it's well done, and it kind of got released and just disappeared.
I remember that coming out. I mean, to be honest, I think by the sort of early to mid 90s, I was like sort of I think the second movie just sort of like okay, you know, it sort of ruined the whole franchise for me.
Isn't that funny really how it's so funny how the studio, how like comic book companies didn't put value in their creations, and all it would take is a bad movie or a bad TV show like that, and you were just done. Like, that's what happened with me and Tank Girl. I discovered the Tank Girl comics in my local comic shop by accident, and I just became a fanatic for the artist Jamie Hewlett. And when that movie was coming out, I was like, I was kind of excited, but I was like, how are they going to pull this off? That's so bizarre.
They did not.
And I remember sitting in the theater. That was one of those moments, like you said, Corey, where I was sitting in the theater just being like, oh man, this is just crap. And it just, like, your heart sinks, and you're just like, I'm done with the whole thing. Like, I can't. Especially
just wash your hands of it.
Yeah, you're just like, I'm done with you. And it took me a long time to even, you know, be able to hear the words Tank Girl without any disdain. Just like,
what was frustrating too is the first movie, like what we said, was you know, fairly cool, and then but the tone of the second movie was like so much goofier, and it was just they really embraced like the stupidity of it, you know.
It's at that point it became again selling toys and product stuff like that, which is the same things with the Batman things, you know, that we heard Michael Uslan go into how the Schumacher era was where it sort of all became about toys and how many times can you change their costumes in the movie so that you can get a certain number of toys out of it.
Which to some stuff still is. All right.
What's your pick, Christian?
Okay, I quickly rewatched this morning. I fast forwarded it through it. I fast forwarded through a couple of things because, like I said, I was sick this week, but I was too sick to indulge in bad superhero movies while sitting comatose on the couch. So I tried to watch.
You don't want to do. Stuff. You don't want to do that with the flu. That could take you to a bad spot.
But this, to me, quite honestly, has to be the worst superhero movie of all time, and it hurts me because when I saw it, this movie was coming out and I was so excited. I was very excited for it, and I remember dragging my friends to go see it to a theater in Fort Lee, New Jersey, and it came out in the summertime, and it was definitely one of those feelings where you're watching the movie and not only are you embarrassed for yourself, but like I dragged my friends to this. Like,
right.
That was like, wow, okay, they are going to hate me forever. Like, this is the worst. And we all should have known better because it's a sequel. But Superman 4, The Quest for Peace.
Yeah.
I mean, really, you don't really need to say anything, but I. Like I said, I quickly fast-forwarded through this and stopped in key scenes. And the thing that is shocking to me, I had not touched this DVD. Now, there's Amy, my wife, has only seen the first two Superman movies. I will not let her watch Superman 3. I will not let her watch Superman 4. In her reality, it stops at 2. And that's
a pretty good reality.
That's a good reality to live
exactly.
in.
Exactly. Because I knew that as soon as like we got past that, like my wife would be like, I kind of lost all respect for you and your love of this character in comic books. And so, but I still think that Superman 3 has some sort of redeeming value in certain sequences, like the sequence where Clark kind of gets cloned and, you know what I'm saying? And you know, he gets doubled with
the... Yeah, I know. Without sort of the Richard Pryor subplot kind of thing, though, it does still, you know, make some sort of a sense, you know.
There's some moments.
You get the sense that there could have been a good movie there, you know.
And Lana Lang. I like the Lana Lang Smallville stuff. I like all that stuff in Superman 3. Superman 4 is... It's horrible. It's just terrible. It's like...
I think my favorite commentary on that movie was my roommate in college got the biography of Christopher Reeve.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's going, you know, he's reading through it.
Yeah.
And he gets to the chapter on Superman 4.
Yeah.
I will read to you the entire chapter.
Oh, oh my God.
The less said about Superman 4, the better. Big break, next chapter.
Oh my God, really?
Yeah.
Oh my
God. He just skipped over that entire part of his life because it's just like, no,
oh my
I don't
God,
even want to.
That's so funny. Well, I did some research today and I was watching it and I was thinking, how could it get this bad? And for anyone who has not seen it, which is probably a lot of younger people out there, well, you don't need to see it. Unfortunately, at this point, the whole thing has gone completely off the rails. Christopher Reeve, you know, I have a ton of respect for Christopher Reeve. I respect his memory, but and I'm not trying to besmirch his character at all whatsoever for doing this film, but he had story input, and I guess there's a lot of anti-nuclear war you know, rhetoric in this movie, right. Which, you know, is fine. It's 1986. At that point, we were all starting to realize, you know, we're just going to blow each other up.
Christopher Reeve obviously has, you know, a humanitarian bent, you know, has always sort of had that. So.
Sure.
I get it. I understand that.
And I will say that it is not the anti-nuclear war stance that ruins movie. There are so many ridiculous subplots and so much bad shoehorning of characters and so much ridiculous force slapstick on the Clark Kent character. It just gets to... It becomes a comedy of errors in filmmaking. It's just like, what are you trying to do here? Like, they introduce Mariel Hemingway, who is, I guess... Okay, so basically what happens is that there is Rupert Murdoch type character who buys the Daily Planet and turns it into a gossip rag. So he has his young daughter, a spoiled rich kid, played by Mariel Hemingway, who apparently back then was like the hotness, and to run the Daily Planet. And ooh, the twist here is that Mariel Hemingway's character has no interest in Superman. She's attracted to Clark. So, of course, you've got the movie, her trying to sort of romance Clark and him awkwardly trying to rebuff her romances and, you know, not get too involved with her. But Mariel Hemingway is obviously introduced into the series as a young, attractive woman that can sort of maybe pick up the mantle of Margot Kidder, who is obviously aging badly in the movie, and who's still very much committed to her character Lois Lane. But you know what I mean? It's so sexist.
And you know, one of the other things too is like just in terms of like the overall Superman universe, it doesn't make any sense because Clark was sent to Earth to be, you know, the guiding light of, you know, of everything. And then, you know, at one point, you know, when the United States and the Soviet Union are on the brink of a nuclear war, he goes to the Fortress of Solitude to you know, to sort of commune with, you know, Jor-El or whatever. And you know, what's Jor-El's recommendation? Well, you know, you should leave Earth and find a new home. Like, really?
Yeah, I know, right?
I just give up.
Exactly. It's like, you know, screw them. You know, you're a god on that planet. Leave it.
Yeah, I know. It's like, what's the point of Superman? But okay, so, and then basically that's like one of the subplots in the movie. But the whole thing is that there's a little kid and he writes Superman a letter. Can you get rid of all the nuclear weapons? And Superman's like thinks about it a little bit and he's like, yeah, sure, I'll get rid of all the nuclear weapons. And so basically he all the nations of Earth gather together and they help get rid of their nuclear weapons. And Superman gathers them all in a giant net and makes them into a ball and swings them into the sun. What?
And so then the nuclear radiation kills us all.
Yeah, exactly. But not even that. It's just then Lex Luthor is approached by sort of like a conglomerate of people, and they're like, "Well, we don't like this. We want to keep the nuclear arms race going." So Lex Luthor creates a nuclear man out of
sort of a nuclear clone of Superman, right?
Yes, and Nuclear Man comes back, but his weakness is that if he gets put in the dark, in the shade for too long, he just shuts down, which is like, that's worse than kryptonite, dude. There's like, I'm sitting in the shade right now as I talk to you on this podcast. Like, it's just
so basically, you know, if he sat through a Batman movie, he would be completely powerless.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I think that, like, there was, they had the basic sort of like framework of a story that could have worked and been interesting, but you've got like so many different subplots fighting for each other that it just becomes a big mess. And then you compound that by the fact that from the reading that I've done, that the company that put it together had something like 30 pictures in development at the time couldn't spend the money that it needed to spend on it.
It's just terrible. They became the original one was produced by the Salkins, you know.
The original
Alexander and Elias Salkin. Yeah, but this one was done by the quite infamous Canon Films, which were owned operated by Menahem Golan. Golan and Menachem Globus. It's Golan Globus is the guys, and man, they're responsible for
many more films.
They're responsible for about a quarter of our list.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, and that's the thing is that this thing could have been, you could take this plot, the basics of this plot, and you could rework it into, it wouldn't even have to be a Superman film. It could be like an Authority comic book script. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Like, I'm watching it and it's just like, maybe it's just me trying to be positive, but I'm like, there's the kernel of a really good idea for a really good story for a script that could have worked really well for Superman, but you know, it was a
rush job, you know.
Yeah.
Like that's really what it was, is that, you know, they were trying to, you know, it was a rush in so many ways. They were trying to, you know, get it while Christopher Reeve could still, you know, do Superman.
Yeah.
They were trying to do it, you know, Canon Films has an incredible lineup. I mean, you know, they've got so many movies, and there are a few good movies in the Canon, vault there.
But, oh yeah.
But you know, like, their approach was so shotgun. You know,
it like seems almost. It seems like they were almost setting up for kind of Superman: The Next Generation with the Mariel Hemingway character and John Cryer, which I didn't realize that was John Cryer Luther's son. I guess.
No, it's his.
Or
nephew.
No, I guess he's just a. Oh, he's a nephew. He's a nephew.
It's his nephew, and but, you know. He's horrible in it. And he makes me. He made me want to claw my newly resurfaced eyeballs out. My LASIK.
Wait a minute. Like, where had they gone?
Oh my God! It's just no. It just made me just want to just like tear my eyes. He's horrible. Like John Cryer. How does that guy still have a career? Like he made Pretty in Pink, and he did this. And what else has he done? I mean, besides.
He was obviously in Two and a Half Men.
No, but before that, like, what? Why does this guy have such distinction amongst Hollywood and actors? Is he like part of a royal Hollywood royalty, or does his family have money, or like what?
It's the Illuminati, man.
Oh, his mother was a playwright,
okay,
singer, and Donald David Cryer was his father, actor, singer.
Family business, and
he's obviously the replacement for not having Ned Beatty as Otis in this, and it's really bad. And he plays this new sort of new wave punk, goth, whatever kid who's an idiot and stumbling through, and he's nowhere near as talented as Ned Beatty was, and it's just really bad. And I can only imagine that Gene Hackman got like such a huge paycheck for this.
Oh, yeah.
Because
the whole budget of the thing was like $17 million. I mean, this suffered from the what I call the Planet of the Apes sequelitis. Yeah. Where Planet of the Apes movies, what they did is, you know, every time they put a sequel out to it, they would slash the budget on it.
Yeah.
So that they would try to make more off of a cheaper product, you know, where now people tend to invest more in the sequels, to, you know, maintain the quality. That wasn't the philosophy then. The philosophy then was like, okay, if you had a hit, you tried to make it again, but on a cheaper budget, so that you know you would make more money.
Yeah.
And it really shows. The effects in Superman IV are. Well, I mean, you know, they're bad. They're bad for the time.
Yeah.
And they're worse than the first two movies. You know.
Yeah.
The first two movies, special effects just blow this one's out of the water.
Well, it's really interesting because it seems like having watched some of it this morning, fast forwarded through it. It really seems like they're reusing a lot of blue screen, like the Christopher Reeve flying blue screen shots on a different background. Like they're using the same shots from like Superman 1 and 2 and they're inserting them into Superman 4 backgrounds. That's the first thing. And the second thing is that the new blue screen stuff or whatever of Nuclear Man flying or whatever is really not much better than the stuff that they've pulled from the first two movies. And then on top of that, there is a really decent sort of sequence towards the end where they fight on the moon, where I was watching and I was like, oh, this is where a lot of the money must have gone. But it's so scattershot. And the really horrifying thing is when I got to the extras on the DVD, like I said, I had not touched this disc from when I bought the Superman DVD set originally, how much worse the movie could have been, because they shot a whole sequence with sort of like a bizarro Nuclear Man prototype where they try and clone Superman or whatever, and it comes out and the dude's got spiky hair and he's naked and he's got like a metal cup over his private parts and he's like Father Luther, and then there's like a nightclub fight scene, and
they could have gotten Vanilla Ice in that, that would have
been... I know, but it's just how much worse it could have gotten, and it's just like it's unbelievable to me. And here, reading this morning that the only reason that Reeve did it was because A, he might have gotten directing to direct the fifth one, if there was a fifth one, and that the production company promised him that they would produce anything he wanted if he did this movie, and he got Street Smart out of that, which was obviously one of his best performances, you know, Christopher Reeve's. So skip Superman 4 and watch Street Smart. That's all I'm telling you, because that is the legacy of this movie, Superman 4, is that it gave us Street Smart with Morgan Freeman and Christopher Reeve, right? So I don't know how much more I could trash on this movie except to get a canister of the film and urinate on it. But I mean,
Okay. Well, if you're talking about let's stay with Superman, man, because my next one, my next one is Superman Returns,
which, as one of the worst of all time.
Yeah.
Wow. You don't think it has enough decent stuff in there to?
No. I mean, no. See, that's the thing is, I think that there's a lot of good stuff in it, but I can't think of any other superhero movie other than, you know, Batman and Robin, which is the biggest turd of all time, that just takes its main character and takes a steaming dump on it and makes it into something that makes that character into someone that they're not.
Well, just get ready for Man of Steel, because I think that's coming.
In Man of Steel, is Superman going to knock up Lois Lane and then take away her memory?
I hope.
And then leave her for 6 years and come back? I didn't hate the movie as much when I saw it as much as I do now, but the more I think about it, it just turns Superman into the most horrible person in the universe.
Yeah, he's ridiculous. You know,
one of the interesting subplots I find out about Superman Returns is that, you know, Lois Lane now has a new boyfriend who's played by the Cyclops guy. James Marsden.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah. And dude, James Marsden is so much more likable than Superman.
Yeah, absolutely.
Through the whole movie.
Yeah. What's that noise?
That was apparently there's a motorcycle race going on.
Nice. Awesome. You're absolutely right that James Marsden is more sympathetic character than the lead character is, which is so bizarre.
I think if you look back at the original notes of Siegel and Schuster, I think they say deadbeat dad Superman. I think that was the original concept.
Yeah, that was in their liner notes.
Yeah. I think that sort of whole story element was really stupid. But yeah. I think even the bigger sin is that aside from the really cool plane crash scene in the beginning, most of the movie is just redundant in that it's basically trying to be a Christopher Reeve Superman movie, and to me that's more offensive than trying something that's different and failing, because it's like we already saw those movies.
Absolutely right, and it's basically so many sequences of it are remade from the first movie. I mean you've got so many beats of the movie that are just the first movie with new technology and, you know, like him catching the plane is him catching the helicopter in the first movie. You know, saving Parker Posey in the car is him saving Miss Tessmacher. The Tessmacher crash where they're trying to distract the nuclear bomb and the nuclear missiles in the first movie. There are just so many beats in Superman Returns that are just carbon copied from the original Superman movie, and it's like, well, what are you trying to do? But beyond the deadbeat dad thing, I knew that we were in trouble going into the movie, because the whole thing of like Superman leaves for 6 years, like he's not going to leave for 6 years. He's just not. The character of Superman is just not going to do that. Like he did do it in the comics, like during the Byrne era, but he didn't leave for 6 years. He left for a couple of months. You know what I'm saying? Like there's no way that he's going to. And apparently, from what I understood in the movie, like the plot in the movie, is that he knows that he's going to be gone for 6 years. It's not like he flies away and tries to find Krypton and then gets sucked into a black hole and is gone for 6 years and is like, oh shit, I didn't mean to be gone for 6 years. He's like, no, you know what? Fuck you all. I'm going to go look at my planet because it's so important to me. I'm going to leave for 6 years. All that shit that's going on with like robbers and earthquakes and things that I can help out with. Yeah, you're all fucked because I need to go check out my heritage. No, Superman doesn't do that. Like, he's bigger than that. You know what I'm saying? And that's the other thing that bothers me too, is that by that time, I mean, when by the time Superman's Superman, at least in the modern interpretation, he considers himself from Earth. You know what I'm saying? Like, he's his heritage is from Krypton. It's like the same thing as my mom's Colombian and my dad is from Estonia. I'm an American. I consider myself an American. I love to go visit and check those places. But, you know, this is what I consider myself. My loyalty is to this country. So in my mind, Superman's loyalty has always been to Earth because we're the planet that took him in and raised him and, you know, Ma and Pa Kent. So anyway, I knew I was in trouble with the story when we were going in. And I remember really liking the airplane crash, but then once you got to creepy Superman spying X-ray vision dad, like, and as good a job as Brandon Routh did in doing an impersonation of Christopher Reeve, you know, I mean, you're just, and then the whole truth, justice, and whatever else, you know, it's like, come on, dude, like, really? Let's you know, but DC Comics has already crapped on that too, because like they did that whole issue of Superman where he like renounces his American heritage. It's like, come on, guys.
It was sort of a letdown because they had the opportunity to, you know, reboot the series, you know, and take it off in a new direction. But like they chose to copy the 1970s version.
Yeah.
You know? And it just didn't. I'm still puzzled by that choice.
Yeah.
You know, I know that, you know, Singer and, you know, all the others really loved those movies, and I love those movies too, but, you know, it's like, if you're making a modern Superman movie, then, you know, make a modern Superman movie. You don't have to, you know, copy so much from what came before.
Yeah. I suspect it's the only thing they could get the studios to greenlight.
Yeah, I think
you're right. We're just gonna mimic what was successful before. Ah, well, then go ahead.
Yeah, yeah. But it's so interesting because they don't remember 3 and 4. You know what I mean? Right. It's like,
yeah,
you know, yeah, you try anything. And there's so much potential. I mean, the big joke when that movie came out is you've got all this technology, and basically, what is Superman doing? He's lifting heavy things again. It's like he's not. There's no giant robots that he's fighting, or, you know what I'm saying?
And there's no consistency in the, you know, lifting heavy things too, because suddenly he's able to lift a heavy rock that's full of kryptonite.
Kryptonite!
You know?
Yeah! I remember being furious. I'm like, we do get that that's the one big thing that he cannot stand, right? Like, did we forget that? Like, oh, I was so mad. Oh, yeah.
And for those reasons, I think it deserves inclusion on our worst movie list.
I think you're right. You got me riled up. So yeah, I mean, that works. Corey, what's another pick on your list?
Well, Batman and Robin was on it, so, you know, enough said on that one. So the third one on my list is Spider-Man 3.
Wow, that bad, huh? It's pretty bad.
Yes, I mean, they're always a little sort of rocky. I never was. Well, the first one, I remember being in the theater and being thrilled at the web swinging and just feeling like, wow, they're really depicting his powers, and like, it feels so cool and looks so fun to be Spider-Man. And then I watched the DVD and I was like, you know, like a year later or whatever, and I was like, sure, yeah, it's still okay.
Yeah.
And then I watched the second one in the theaters, and it was like, yeah, it was fun. There were some good moments, you know, the Doc Ock throwing bags of money around. That's fun.
Yeah.
So they were never were my absolute favorite, but they were good enough. And then the third one just felt like, again, the moment was when Peter Parker is walking down the street singing. Uh-huh. And he's suddenly playing the piano, and it's like,
the dance number.
What is going on? What movie am I watching?
Yeah, yeah.
I remember looking, seeing that scene, and I leaned forward and looked down the row at a friend of mine, and we both just exchanged just aghast looks of, did they just switch reels?
Yeah.
What happened?
Yeah, it's really, I think at this point, Like, I think three is sort of what I expected out of one when I heard that Sam Raimi was directing the Spider-Man movie, because Raimi is a great director. Let's no doubt about that. But when they announced that he was directing Spider-Man 1, the only things I could think of were Evil Dead 2, which I think is a great film. I don't get me wrong, but it's wacky, and it's got like a wacky sense of humor. And I see no real place for that sort of sense of humor in Spider-Man. Like that, okay. I see a place for a sense of humor in a Spider-Man movie, but not that sense of humor. You see what I'm saying? Right. And then the other thing, the other movie was Darkman. Where I never liked Darkman. I always hated that movie. I never thought it. I shouldn't say I hated it. I just don't get why a lot of other nerds regard it as really great. Maybe I need to see it again. But I remember being sort of scared. And then when the first one came out, I have to say that when I saw the first movie, and this was very much like an opening day feeling, and Paul, I don't know if you were there, like, did we all, I remember seeing it in a group together.
Yeah, I think we may have.
Yeah, and I remember distinctly having a feeling of like, this is exactly what I felt like when I saw the first Superman movie in the theater. Like, I can't believe I'm seeing a semi, like, a very decent Spider-Man movie, like, that he's swinging around and, you know, all this stuff. I had problems with the Green Goblin, but once you get to three, you can tell that this is sort of Sam Raimi being like, all right, I'm locked into this. I've got to make this movie. They want Venom in it. And I think maybe he's a little tired of being fucked with. You know what I'm saying? And I think he's like, well, I'm just going to interject my sense of humor. Because he does it a little bit with the Doc Ock birth scene in the second movie, where it's like the doctors are trying to operate him on and the arms come to life and it's like, you know, but I think.
But I didn't mind that.
No, I didn't mind it either. I thought it was perfect.
And it wasn't really played for laughs.
It wasn't played for laughs.
Like, but that was definitely the most, you know, if you're thinking of like the sort of Raimi style, that scene is definitely the most Raimi-esque.
Yeah, and it fit in the second movie. In the third movie, I think at this point he's like, you know what, I'm gonna do something. I think he's smarter than that. I don't think he's stupid. And I think he was just like, I'm going to do something that is going to be so weird that I'm going to enjoy doing and is going to be so different than what we've been doing. Maybe because he was bored, you know, and maybe because he was like, I just don't want to do these movies anymore. You know what I mean? I'm going to do something so wacky that I won't have to do another one of these. You know what I mean? Well, does that seem to give like giving Sam Raimi too much credit?
I can go with no, I don't think so at all, because you know there is definitely a lot of, you know, producer interference in this. I mean, Raimi's been clear about that. You know, I think that everybody knows he didn't want to do Venom. You know? I mean, even the cinematographer of the movie, you know, Bill Pope was like, just talks like why are you doing Venom? Because, you know, you've got like, you're shooting this thing at night and you've got, you know, a monster that's dressed in black, you know, and it's like, it's just a pain.
Yeah.
You know, they wanted to have all these villains in there. They wanted to have Gwen Stacy in there. They wanted to have, you know, it seemed like this was the movie where they tried to pack too much into, you know, into what an hour and a half, close to 2 hour runtime. You know, they really did try to put too much in there. And you know, the other thing where it sort of falls apart is, you know, two is just such a much better movie. Two is one of my favorite superhero movies of all time, and you know, it really fell far from that.
Big time. Because I remember watching two and thinking, wow, Doc Ock is a badass. And I'd never thought that before, like reading the comics. I always just thought he was kind of like a minor villain. And I just remember watching two and I guess it's one of the things that film can do that maybe comics sometimes can't, which is like that those arms coming at you constantly. Like, I remember just thinking that like, he's scary. And in the comics, I never thought that before. I was like, that's frightening. Like, that dude coming at you with those arms? Like, there's no way. I would be horrified, you know? And to be Spider-Man and have to decide, like, hey, guess what? I'm going into that? That takes a lot of guts. You know what I mean? But like talking about three is also the other thing is too many villains. Like yeah. you've got the Sandman, which that Sandman birthing scene is beautiful. Like when he pulls himself together out of the sand.
Yeah,
I'm really, really impressed with that. And then they're trying to, you know, stick James Franco in there. Who
yeah, that killed it for me. The whole new goblin thing. I mean, if you were, I could see you doing, you know, the Sandman and Venom, or I could see you doing Venom and the new goblin, but like just having like, you know, that many villains coming at you, you know, it's like you just can't resolve those things adequately.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was really like the Sandman part was probably the most interesting. And I thought Thomas Hayden Church, I mean, he's just an interesting actor, I think. And and even though they did sort of what they did with the Sandman backstory.
Yeah.
I mean, I was fine with that. I didn't mind that, you know, the daughter thing and all that stuff.
No, I agree.
That I think that should have been just that be your villain and just focus on that and maybe have the James Franco stuff because that has been a continual subplot throughout all the movies. So keep that and the Venom. I mean, I think Venom's a fine villain, but I think it's just you know, Sandman's the stronger piece and just stick with that.
So do you like Venom? Because I've always hated Venom.
I don't mind him. He's whatever. It's
no, I hate him. I can't stand Venom. Venom to me, sort of. I like the alien costume thing, like when he got the new costume in the 80s. But the introduction of Venom and like keeping him around as a villain, as he's an uninteresting character from the beginning, and I think that to me that signaled the death knell of like the interest in the Spider-Man character when they kept Venom around. I was just like,
they certainly played out that concept quite a bit.
Boy, did they! Boy,
you know, I think
boy.
Another thing that went wrong with 3 is something that went wrong with the comic books, and that's Mary Jane Watson.
Yeah.
Becoming this successful actress, you know, in the comics she became a successful model.
Yeah,
you know,
supermodel.
And you know, and in this one she's, you know, a Broadway actress who works at, you know, some sort of like nightclub too. I think Spider-Man always worked better in the comics, you know, when he was sort of struggling to get by and his friends, you know, who were better off than he was, but, you know, they weren't, you know, with the exception of, you know, Osborne, they weren't wealthy, you know, supermodel successful people or anything like that, you know.
Yeah.
But, you know, suddenly, I don't know, it's just like having her be, you know, having her hit Peter have to deal with her success kind of thing, just, I've never really thought that was a great, interesting thing in the comics, and in the movie it led to some of the most idiotic things.
I'm pretty sure it was 3 with that hospital scene with the two of them. It was just, oh god. I mean, I never cared about their chemistry. I always thought it was just pretty awful. But that scene in particular, they were in a hospital.
Well,
and then he was in the hospital, and
And sticking Gwen Stacy in there where she kind of didn't need to be, right? I mean,
because they had already sort of done her plot in the first movie with Mary Jane.
Exactly.
You know, that's what I didn't understand about that. You know?
Yeah.
And I think that the new series is being much smarter about the Gwen Stacy.
Thing,
you know, by building the character up over the period of movies and then, you know, and then sicking the goblin on her,
it's,
you know what I mean?
It's interesting because it's like we can criticize the first series as much as we want, but the second series has the luxury of being able to look back and do that, whereas in the original series, they didn't know whether they were going to get another movie or not. They were just like, we got to just stick it all in there, you know?
Right.
How was that one? I haven't seen the Garfield one.
Oh, it's really good. Really? I don't like the lizard stuff so much. Mm-hmm. But what do you think, Paul? I liked it.
I think it's really good. It's a really, really well done.
You should rent it.
I've heard nobody talk about it. Like, it came out and nobody seemed to really respond to it.
No, actually, Christian, I think you liked it better than Dark Knight Rises, didn't you?
Oh yeah, big time. Yeah. I just thought it was more fun, and their chemistry is fantastic. Like the two lead characters. I think that you should definitely check out that third one, that one that they made. But before we get on to the next movie. Did you guys ever see that sort of test footage that they did of the lizard for the first Spider-Man? Apparently,
no.
Raimi, I don't know if it's rumor or fact or whatever, but Raimi wanted the lizard for Spider-Man 1, and he got the Green Goblin kind of crammed down his throat, and they did some test shoots.
Painful.
Yeah.
Yeah. But they did that some, big helmet.
Yeah, I know. But they did some test shoots for test effect stuff of the lizard, and I think if you Google it, you can see it, and it's pretty awesome stuff. It's like, oh, can you imagine like what that movie would have been like? So
yeah,
it would have been totally awesome. So
yeah, I think the main thing with Spider-Man 3 for me is just the disappointment after Spider-Man 2.
Yeah.
You know, it's sort of, I mean, I can imagine, because I never saw Superman 3 in the theater.
Oh.
But I can imagine that people got the same feeling there after Superman 2, then watching Superman 3, and just sort of that it goes off in a new direction that's just not very good, and you know.
Absolutely, you are 100%
correct. I'm sure
that's
what it is.
You are 100% correct. Yeah, so let's move on to the next movie. We've given Spider-Man 3 more time than it deserves, I think.
Okay, so this is Christian Horn of Part-Time Fanboy. That was part one of our Worst Superhero Movies Ever episode. We hope you enjoyed listening to it as much as we enjoyed recording it. Please take time next week to join us again for part two of Worst Superhero Movies Ever. And have a great week, and thanks for listening. Bye.
Part-Time Fanboy. Fanboy.com.